We gather to seek, to find, and to share the promise of honest religion. And so it is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this.
A place for questions more profound than answers.
Vulnerability more powerful than strength.
And a peace that can pass all understanding.
It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. Candles, through some beautiful choral music, through prayer and silence, we can get in touch with and dwell in our centers. You may use these first moments for lighting candles or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here. Please join with me in a spirit of prayer. Let us be pulled into spiritual paths that leave us with a good aftertaste. There is so much religious advice telling us how we had better get in line with this or that set of beliefs being hawked by churches and preachers who sometimes feel too slick or mean. But their certainty is too simple, doesn't have a good smell to it, and it leaves a bad aftertaste. Let us instead be lured into paths of loving others as we love ourselves, and loving ourselves as children of God, the sons and daughters of life's high longing for itself. Such spiritual paths are very simple, but they have an aroma and an aftertaste that is still pleasing even years later. So much in life can be identified by the lasting taste and smell that it leaves with us. Let us learn to be drawn to the places that smell good, that smell like ambrosia or the scent of those angels of our better nature. Amen. I found that it's hard to answer questions of belief that are both honest and interesting. Maybe all I can do here is let you hear how I'm grappling with this so that it might help you grapple with it in your own way. One way of getting into the complexities of belief today is through understanding the complexities of families today. For a couple decades at least, we've been used to the phrase his, hers, and ours to describe what we have been taught to call blended families. Other siblings, parents, or other relatives or friends often become at least temporary parts of families too, as with the family who lit our candles this morning, and as with some of your families. And what's true of our blended families is also true of the blend of beliefs that we each carry around. Honest religious belief can never again be the simplistic kind of white bread thing that we thought it was 50 years ago. The things we cling to today are blended families of beliefs that borrow from all over the world map. In old-time religion, it might have seemed sufficient to recite a creed that had been cobbled together many centuries before by people living in a very different world, as though that could do more than make us sort of uncritical members of a very old club with questionable connection to our lives today. Now the lights from which we find our enlightenment come in many different sizes, shapes, and genders, like the lights on our altar this morning. Men, women, children, experiences we never expected to change our life, but which did change them. Wisdom we've read everywhere, in self-help books, business books, snippets of Buddhist or Christian or philosophical thought, lines from movies or songs, readings from astrology, things we heard on Oprah, comments from family or friends, therapists or preachers that stick with us, all blended together into our traveling carnival of practical wisdom. Using this bit today, that bit tomorrow, never noticing that this bit and that bit may in fact contradict one another. Defining ourselves by beliefs today doesn't work very well. In this more complex world of spirituality, orthodoxy is always too small for the real world. It creates too many theological fights, some of them deadly, that amount to a church or a preacher restricting God and life to the limits of their tastes and their understanding, exalting a creed written years or centuries earlier by people we don't even know. And sometimes getting downright hateful toward those who don't share the beliefs of their church, though not the church across the street from them. Now, I'm a theologian. That's what I did my PhD in. So I can tell you, as a theologian, this is authoritative now, that to exalt beliefs is to give way too much credit to theologians. They're academics. They're not experts in life. They're experts in thinking about theology. And there's no secret knowledge. You may have thought there was. But I can tell you, after 7 years in a good graduate school, reading a lot of books, if there were secret knowledge available to theologians, I'd have found it. There isn't any. Talking to a theologian, to bring this way down to earth, is a little like talking to a Buick salesman. He can tell you a lot about Buicks, but don't trust him to tell you what the best car is, or whether you need a Buick, or whether you even need a car, because he doesn't know much more about that than you do. Also, he has a conflict of interests. His job is to sell you Buicks. Now, the same is true with theologians. They can tell you about their personal brand of religion, but they can't tell you whether you need it or whether it's better for you than other religions or no religion. They also have a conflict of interests. They're there to sell you their kind of religion. And most of them honestly think that's all there is that really counts, just like a Buick salesman. So as a theologian, I want to say, don't worry too much about gods that you can't see, and don't worry about theologians trying to tell you about these gods that you can't see and that they can't see either. If we live like that Roman family, we'll have a pretty sweet-smelling religion and life, however we get there. I think orthodoxies and polished belief statements are largely perfumed, and they're like advertising brochures that are slick but often have very little to do with the product being sold, or in this case, with the lives being led by the believers. Think of that Roman family in the reading by Ralph Waldo Emerson. They were completely outside the acceptable beliefs that Friar Bernard had learned. And so he prayed for his God to destroy them. Astounding. His beliefs were making him small and dangerous in a world that had already gone way beyond them, the way the world usually goes, way beyond the boundaries of beliefs. He was a relatively powerless man, but if he'd had power, he could have been extremely dangerous. It was starting to smell bad. But then his humanity somehow trumped his theology, He realized that these were cultured and caring people. They were lovers, even. And his whole world of beliefs was thrown out of order. His beliefs no longer seemed so valid or so profound, and that's the way it's supposed to work. The Romans had a saying that we should live as though all the truly decent people who had ever lived were watching us. And then we should do only what we could proudly do in front of that kind of an audience. And in this story, they certainly behaved that way. Their beliefs served them and others because their religion wasn't about beliefs. It was about behavior. If Friar Bernard's God was watching him, as the Romans felt that their gods were watching them, Friar Bernard's God would have been pleased at Friar Bernard's final wail, but not at his early arrogant position of wanting those whose beliefs had outgrown him to be destroyed for that sin. So what do we believe? I think this is a hard question. Usually when we're asked what we believe, we try to think of some really slick belief statements that somebody taught us because they sound so much more impressive than something we could just make up on the spot. It's almost as though the question, what do you believe, isn't about us anymore. It's just about what are the slickest sounding beliefs you can remember from wherever you got them that you think you can fool me with. I have a story about this that goes back half a dozen years. To our first ministerial intern, Kathy Harrington. Kathy had been raised Christian Scientist when she came here, and she got very angry at me very early when I said that one of the rules for the pulpit here was that we may not use words whose meanings we don't know, and that includes religious jargon, and it includes the word God. She could feel free to use the word as long as she could tell the congregation what she meant by it. She was very angry. She said that was the most ridiculous thing she'd ever heard. No one had ever asked her to define God. No one at seminary had ever asked that question. And I said, well, it's high time you learned what you think you mean by the word. And when you figure it out, you can use it. So this went on 5 or 6 months, and there would be snarling every once in a while just to make sure that I was aware that she was angry about this. Around March, I think, she came in to see me and sat down and said, all right, I'm preaching about God this Sunday. And I said, well, this should be very interesting. I said, what are you going to tell them it means? She said, you see, that's the problem. She said, that's the problem with this business of you have to know what you mean by before you can say it. That's what's wrong with this approach of yours. She said, because I do know what I mean by it now, and it's not impressive. She said, when I could say I'm here to preach God to you, she said, that's impressive. That's dramatic. She said, you can take that to the bank. You can put that on billboards. She said, what I believe, what's really sacred to me, she said, it's not impressive. And I said, well, this is a great downer. So I said, how are you going to depress all the people this Sunday? What's this about? I said, tell me what you believe. And she said, it's embarrassing to say it out loud. That's why I'd rather just use words like God. She said, the whole New Testament for me is summed up in one story, and not even one of the most famous stories. Not even a saying of Jesus, for God's sake. She said, the whole thing is summed up for me in that story of Jesus washing his disciples' feet. She said, that's it. She said, now how impressive is that? She said, it's service. One word. The whole Bible. She said, that's it for me. It's service, period. She said, this isn't even dramatic. And I said, well, play your sad little drama Sunday and we'll see how people react to it. I think there were not a lot of dry eyes that Sunday. because it just was so very real. So instead of drama, she substituted authenticity. And suddenly it was sacred. That's the magic of honest religion. There's so many problems starting with beliefs. When conservatives do it, we liberals love to pick them apart. It's one of our favorite sports. So somebody says, well, I believe in this God who created the whole universe, and he loves me. And you think, well, that's dramatic. But we can't even imagine how big the universe is. Billions of galaxies. We don't even know how to imagine a billion. I read somewhere that a million seconds is about 11 and a half days, but a billion seconds is more than 35 years. I can't even get my head around that. I certainly can't get my head around billions of galaxies. What on earth does it mean to believe in a God that created this whole thing that we don't even know how to imagine? And worse than that, 3,000 years ago, when that God first evolved in a very, very ancient Hebrew tribe, their notion of the universe was that the whole thing was smaller than the state of Texas. All right, a lot of Texans still think that. But if we try to use our own words or slogans instead of these very dramatic sounding statements, the words and slogans that we hear in our special fully evolved liberal groups, it can get just as arrogant, and it may not be any more truthful. For instance, if we say we believe in deeds, not creeds, we love to say that. It really sounds good. Just what deeds can we point to that we've actually done in the last week? And how impressive do they sound? If we say we celebrate freedom of belief, that's another really impressive one. What examples can we think of that involve our children, our family, or our partner choosing beliefs that we hate and actually celebrating that? Not tolerating, celebrating. If we say we believe in fighting for justice, what examples can we think of that we've done that don't sound just really trivial? The trouble with using polished and rehearsed little bromides is that they'll usually sound more impressive than our lives actually look. And religion isn't about putting on a pious front or trying to impress anybody with our purity or our righteousness. It has a bad aroma, but it doesn't really fool anybody either. And if we can't even fool each other, do we really think we could fool God? It seems so unlikely. When I hold myself against the highest ideals, I have to admit that I don't look very good. I'm not out there saving the world. I don't give a lot of time or money to really, really noble causes, and there are a lot of them. I haven't risked my life like soldiers have, at least not since I was a soldier. Many years ago. I haven't sold everything I own and given it to the poor like Jesus said we were supposed to do. I can resonate with platitudes like, as long as one person isn't free, no one is free. That's really very poetic. It feels very stirring. But I can't think of anything I'm really doing to walk that talk that costs me very much. Send $20 to this or that, that's it. You can say things like, I believe in reason, science, justice, truth, goodness, America, mom, and apple pie. But how much of that was evident in the way you lived last week? Are the beliefs really about you at all, or are they just the cleverest sounding bromides you can think of? And then when we do something really charitable, it gets worse. Because we want credit for it. So then were our motives altruistic or were they self-centered after all? Jesus said to give in secret, not to let your left hand know what your right hand's doing. We probably all admire that degree of humility, but almost none of us has it. We hope somebody notices what we've done, and we're not above finding some sneaky way to tell them. Now, maybe I'm the only one here of whom this is true, but I don't think so. I think there may be a lot of people here who feel that it's about all you can do to do your work, try your best to raise your children well, and have more than a few minutes a day left for quality time with your partner while keeping in touch with the people you love. You might like high-sounding rhetoric, might like good sermons that lift up really noble aspirations. And somewhere in both your head and your heart, you really mean all this as much as you know how to mean anything. But your life doesn't look like the picture of the perfect life found on the cover of the slickest spiritual brochure. So maybe the question is, how do we express ourselves in authentic ways rather than really impressive ways? One answer would be to define ourselves not by beliefs, but by behaviors, and to try and act like all the most decent people on earth were watching us and only do what we would do in front of that audience. There's a big difference between identifying ourselves with beliefs and identifying ourselves by our behaviors. The history of religions has plenty of both. And almost all of the really bad ones were those who exalted rigid beliefs above decent behaviors, as Friar Bernard wanted to do. To pick just two from history, from two different religions, very powerful men, John Calvin and the Ayatollah Khomeini, are examples of this. John Calvin was the 16th century theologian who preached the gospel of original sin and human depravity and taught it to tens of millions of Christians who followed his Calvinist theology. It's a horrid theology. If anything, he was a living example of original sin and human depravity in some of his own behavior. When a brilliant and impertinent and troubling and not very nice Spanish physician, it was the physician who discovered blood circulation, the fact that blood circulates, a man named Michael Servetus. When he wrote an essay on the errors of the Trinity and sent a copy to Calvin, Calvin seethed. When Servetus then had the nerve and or really, really bad judgment to show up one Sunday in Calvin's church in Geneva, Calvin had him arrested and burned alive. But it was more than that. Calvin instructed the killers to tie Servetus in a chair, lower him into the flames, raise him back out, lower him into the flames, raise him back out, so that in all it took more than half an hour before Servetus died. The Ayatollah Khomeini, among other stunning acts, ordered the murder of the novelist Salman Rushdie because one of Rushdie's novels made fun of a fundamentalist Islamic belief. These were both powerful and charismatic men, regarded by their followers as God's agents, though I think not regarded that way by God. But their behavior put the lie to their professed beliefs. Behavior trumps belief. It left a stench in the annals of history. There was nothing of God in either of these men in those actions. Genuine gods don't care whether people buy the stories of this or that preacher, this or that church. They care whether you're coming more alive, whether you're finding the kind of truth that makes you more whole, how you treat others, whether you're a blessing or a curse to the world. One of Emerson's sayings that's in the same key as the reading that Eric read to you is, your actions are screaming so loud that I can't hear what you're saying. The goal in all this is authenticity, not orthodoxy. And I think orthodoxies often offer little more than an anesthetic for those who are afraid or unsure how to become more authentic. It's worth believing not in slick-sounding creeds, but in a sweet-smelling life. And the clues to this are all around, and they constitute the good news that's embedded in life for us. Nothing is hidden. There are no secrets. First, they're in that Roman story. The priest defined himself by beliefs, and we all knew he was too small. It stunk. The Romans never even mentioned beliefs, and even in the story, they smelled sweet. A bigger clue, and a more empowering one, is the fact that we all knew that. We could all tell the difference between the feel and the smell of Friar Bernard's smallness and the largesse of that Roman family. And the best news is that we already act on it. We do it automatically. We do it without even needing to think about it. We just ordained Jack Harris Bonham here. We didn't do it because of his beliefs. I'm not sure what they all are, and I don't much care. We did it because he was here for 2 years, and we came to know his heart and his mind through his actions toward others. And like the Roman family, we knew that this was a decent person and a blessing to the world, whatever beliefs got him there. So what can we say about honest religion that might be useful? One thing is that, again, there is no secret knowledge. There is nothing that is necessary to us that's really hidden. We can hear stories like the reading by Emerson. We can hear awful stories of arrogant men like Calvin or the Ayatollah Khomeini. We can delight in recognizing the goodness and promise of someone like Jack Harris Bonham, and ordain him to whatever kinds of ministry his heart and the whims of the world may lead him to. And we've already shown that we have almost all the spiritual insight and understanding that we need to be saved and to help heal the world around us. It's already in us. Nothing's hidden. We know the difference all the way down in our souls between the stench of bad faith inflicted on ourselves or others and the sweet smell of a life lived pretty fully and well here and now among one another. So at the end of all the religious instruction to sharpen our spiritual senses, part of the lesson can be distilled into one very simple piece of advice. Follow your nose.